Serpukhov Station, pale grey from fear, was dissolving into the darkness. Soldiers in army gas masks had cut it off from the tunnels at both sides and blocked the connecting passage to the circle line, and the station was buzzing like a disturbed beehive in anticipation of disaster. Hunter and Homer were led through the hall with an armed escort, like high-ranking officers, and every inhabitant of Serpukhov tried to look into their eyes to see if they knew what was really happening and if their fate had been decided. Homer stared fixedly at the floor. He didn't want to remember those faces. The brigadier hadn't informed Homer where he intended to go next, but the old man could guess. Ahead of them lay Polis, four metro stations linked together by passages, a genuine city with thousands of inhabitants. The unofficial capital of the metro, which was fractured into dozens of warring feudal principalities. A bulwark of science and refuge of culture. A holy sanctuary that no one dared to invade or attack. No one, that is, apart from Homer, the half-crazed messenger of the plague. But in the last few days he had started feeling better. The nausea had receded, and the consumptive cough that forced him to wash out his bloody respirator had softened a little. Maybe his body had overcome the illness on its own, or maybe there never was any infection at all. Eh? Maybe he was simply too neurotic about his health. He'd always known he had that tendency. But he had still got so terrified. The stretch of tunnel beyond Serpukhov was dark and remote. It had a bad reputation. As far as Homer was aware, they shouldn't encounter a single soul until they reached Polis, but Polyanka, the way station between inhabited Serpukhov and residential Borovitskaya, could surprise travelers. There were numerous legends about Polyanka station circulating in the metro. If they could be believed, this station rarely threatened the lives of those who walked through it, but it could damage their reason. The old man had been here several times, but never encountered anything out of the ordinary. The legends had explanations for that, too. Homer knew all of them. And now he was hoping as hard as he could that this time the station would remain as dead and abandoned as it had been in better times. About 100 meters before Polyanka, he suddenly felt strange, with the first distant glints of white electric light on the station's marble walls and the first echo of fractured sounds coming from it. The old man suspected something was wrong. He could clearly hear human voices. And there was no way that could be right. Even worse, Hunter, who in some mysterious way could sense the presence of any living creatures, remained absolutely deaf and indifferent now. Completely absorbed in his own thoughts, he didn't respond to the old man's agitated glances, as if he couldn't see the visions being revealed to Homer at that moment. The station was occupied. When had they done that? Homer had often wondered why, despite Polyanka's cramped space, the inhabitants of Polis had never tried to annex and develop the empty station. There was nothing to prevent it but the superstitions, but apparently they had proved a sufficiently weighty reason for this strange way station to be left in peace. Until, that is, someone overcame their fear of it and set up a tent town here, put in lighting. God, how extravagant they were with electric power here. Even before the two travelers emerged from the tunnel and started walking along beside the platform, the old man had to put his hand over his eyes to avoid being blinded. Bright mercury lamps were glaring at full power up under the ceiling of the station. Astounding. Not even Polis looked so clean and festive. Not a trace of dust or soot was left on the walls, and the marble slabs all gleamed, while the ceiling looked as if it had been whitewashed only yesterday. Homer couldn't spot a single tent through the arches. Perhaps they hadn't had time to put them up yet, or perhaps they were going to make a museum here. That would be just like the eccentric cranks who ran Polis. The platform gradually filled up with people. They took no interest at all in the cutthroat wearing a titanium helmet who was hung all over with weapons, or the grubby old man hobbling along beside him. Looking closely at them, Homer realized that he didn't have the strength to take another step. His legs had given out. Everyone who came over to the edge of the platform was dressed up as if someone was shooting a film about the 2000s at Polyanka. Brand new coats and raincoats, bright colored down jackets, sky blue jeans. Where were the old padded jackets? Where was the lousy pigskin leather? Where was the perpetual reddish brown of the metro, the graveyard of all colors? Where had all this wealth come from? And the faces. They weren't the faces of people who had lost their entire family in a single moment. They were the faces of people who had seen the sun today and who, well, basically, had started the day with a hot shower. The old man would have bet his life on that. And something else. Many of them seemed vaguely familiar to Homer. More and more of these incredible people appeared, jostling at the edge of the platform. But they didn't get down onto the tracks. Soon the entire station was filled from tunnel to tunnel with the trim, dressy crowd, and still no one looked at Homer. They looked anywhere at all, at the wall, at newspapers, at each other, surreptitiously, lugubriously, or curiously, with loathing or sympathy, but not at the old man, as if he were a ghost. Why had they gathered here? What were they waiting for? Homer finally recovered his wits. Where was the brigadier? How would he explain the inexplicable? Why hadn't he said anything yet? Hunter had stopped a little bit further on. He wasn't even slightly interested in the station, packed tight with people out of photographs that were a quarter of a century old. He was staring somberly into empty space, as if he had run into some kind of barrier, as if there was something hanging in the air in front of him, on a level with his eyes. The old man moved closer to the brigadier and peeped warily under his visor. And then Hunter struck out. His clenched fist tore through the air, moving from left to right along a strange trajectory, as if the brigadier was trying to slash someone invisible with a non-existent knife. He very nearly caught Homer, who jumped aside, but Hunter continued his battle. He struck, then moved back, defending himself, tried to restrain someone in a steely clinch, and a second later was wheezing in a stranglehold himself. Barely managing to break free, he flung himself back into the attack. The battle was slipping away from him. His invisible opponent was getting the upper hand. It was harder and harder for Hunter to get to his feet after those silent but crushing blows. His movements became slower and slower, less and less confident. The old man was haunted by the feeling that he had already seen something like this only very recently. But where and when? And what in hell's name was happening to the brigadier? Homer tried calling to him, but he was possessed, and it was impossible to get him to hear. The people on the platform took absolutely no notice of Homer. For them, he didn't exist. Just as they didn't exist for him. They were concerned about something else. They kept glancing with mounting alarm at their wristwatches, puffing out their cheeks in annoyance, talking to the people next to them and checking the red numbers on the electronic clock above the mouth of the tunnel. Homer screwed up his eyes and looked at it with the others. It was a counter that registered the time since the last train had passed through. But its display seemed unnaturally long, with 10 digits. 8 digits before the blinking colon, and another 2 for the seconds after it. Red dots squirmed, counting off the fleeting seconds, and the final digit in the incredibly long number changed. 12 million and something. There was a scream. And a sob. The old man turned away from the mysterious clock. Hunter was lying motionless, face down on the rails. Homer dashed over to him and turned the heavy, lifeless body face up with a struggle. Yes, the brigadier was breathing, although raggedly, and he didn't have any visible injuries, although his eyes had rolled up and back like a dead man's. His right hand remained clenched, and only now did the old man discover that Hunter had not been fighting this strange duel unarmed. The handle of the black knife was peeping out from his fist. Homer slapped the brigadier hard across the cheeks, and Hunter started blinking, groaning like a man with a hangover. He propped himself up on his elbows and scrutinized the old man with a blurry gaze. Then he jumped to his feet in a single bound and shook himself off. The mirage disappeared. The people in raincoats and bright jackets disappeared without a trace. The blinding light went out, and the dust of decades settled on the walls again. The station was black, empty and lifeless, exactly as Homer remembered it from his previous expeditions. All the way to Oktober Station, neither of them said another word. The only sound came from the guards assigned to them, whispered conversations and puffing and panting when they stumbled over the sleepers. Sasha wasn't even angry with the musician, but with herself. And he... But what about him? He was behaving exactly as he ought to behave. Eventually she even started feeling awkward about what she'd said to Leonid. Perhaps she had been too harsh with him. But then, at Oktober, the wind changed. It was perfectly natural. When Sasha saw this station, she simply forgot about everything else in the world. In the last few days, she had been in places that she wouldn't even have believed existed before. But the finery of Oktober, eclipsed all of them. The granite floors were covered with carpets, worn completely bald, but still retaining their original patterns. Lamps, cast in the form of blazing torches and polished to a high gleam, flooded the hall with an even milky white glow. People with glossy, gleaming faces were sitting at tables standing here and there, occupied in lazy exchanges of words and pieces of paper. "It's so rich here," Sasha said, bewildered, almost twisting her neck as she gazed around. "The Circle Line stations remind me of pieces of pork kebab threaded on a skewer," Leonid whispered to her. "They just ooze fat." "Yes, by the way. Maybe we could have a bite to eat." "We haven't got time," she said, shaking her head and hoping he wouldn't hear the eager rumbling in her stomach. "Oh, come on," said the musician, holding out his hand to her. "There's a little place here. Nothing you've ever eaten before even comes close." "Lads, do you fancy a bit of lunch?" he asked, including the guards in the suggestion. "Don't you worry. We'll get there in a couple of hours. I didn't mention pork kebabs by accident. The food they make here..." He started talking about meat in terms that were almost poetry, and Sasha wavered and gave in. If it was only 2 hours to their destination, a half-hour lunch wouldn't make any difference. They still had almost a whole day in reserve, and who knew when they would next have a chance for a bite to eat. The kebabs lived up to the poetry, too, but things didn't stop there. Leonid ordered a bottle of homebrew as well. Sasha couldn't resist, and she gulped down a little glass out of curiosity. The musician and the guards drank the rest. Later, she came to her senses, jumped up on her limp-feeling legs, and told Leonid to get up in a strict voice, all the stricter because the heady homebrew had made her drowsy, and while they were dining, she had delayed for almost too long before shaking his fingers off her knees. Light, sensitive fingers. Impudent. He had immediately raised his hands in the air. "I surrender." But her skin had remembered his touch. Why had she driven him away so quickly, Sasha wondered, punishing herself with a pinch. Now she would have to erase this bittersweet lunch scene from her memory, shake it up with some meaningless nonsense and sprinkle words over it. "The people here are strange," she said to Leonid. "How?" he asked, draining his glass in one and finally getting up from the table.
"There's something missing in their eyes."
"Hunger," the musician said categorically.
"No, not only that. It's as if they don't want anything else."
"That's because they don't want anything else," Leonid snorted. "They're well fed. Queen Hansa feeds them. And what's wrong with their eyes? Perfectly normal, languid, apathetic eyes."
"When I lived with my father," she said seriously, "what we left today would have lasted us for 3 days. Maybe we should have taken it and given it to someone."
"It's okay. They'll feed it to the dogs," answered the musician. "They don't keep any beggars here."
"But it could have been given to the nearby stations, where there are hungry—"
"Hansa doesn't go in for charity,"
put in one of the guards, the one who was called Kostya.
"Let them shift for themselves. We can do without taking on any idlers."
"Are you a native Circle man yourself?"
Leonid inquired.
"I've always lived here, as long as I can remember."
"Then you may not believe it, but people who weren't born in the Circle have to eat sometimes too,"
the musician told him.
"Let them eat each other. Or maybe it would be better to take everything away from us and divide it up, like the Reds say," the soldier asked aggressively.
"Well, if everything carries on in the same way," Leonid began.
"Then what? You keep your mouth shut, spindle legs. You've already said enough to get yourself deported."
"I arranged to get deported earlier," the musician responded phlegmatically. "That's what we're doing now."
"But I could turn you in to the right people, as a Red spy," said the guard, getting heated.
"And I could turn you in for drinking on duty."
"Why, you. It was you that got us. And you."
"No. We're sorry. He didn't mean to say that," Sasha intervened, clutching the musician's sleeve and pulling him away from Kostya, who had started breathing heavily.
She almost dragged Leonid to the tracks, then looked at the station clock and gasped. Their lunch and the arguments at the station had lasted almost 2 hours. She had set out to compete against Hunter's speed, and he definitely wouldn't have stopped for a second. The musician laughed drunkenly behind her back. All the way to Culture Park, the guards hissed baleful comments. Every now and then, following his natural impulse, Leonid attempted to answer them, and Sasha had to hold him back or persuade him not to. The alcohol continued swirling round in his brain, making him bolder and more insolent. The girl had to dodge constantly to keep out of reach of his wandering hands.
"Don't you like me at all, then?" he asked, offended. "Not your type, is that it? You don't like them like me? You want muscles and scars? Why did you come with me?"
"Because you made me a promise," she pushed Leonid away. "Not so that—"
"I'm not like that," he sighed sadly. "Always the same old story. If I'd known you were such a prig—"
"How can you? There are people here, live people. They'll all die if we don't get there in time."
"What can I do about it? I can hardly move my legs. Do you know how heavy they are? Here, feel. And the people, they'll die anyway, tomorrow or in 10 days' time. And me and you, so what?"
"So you lied. You lied. Homer told me. He warned me. Where are we going?"
"No, I didn't lie. Do you want me to swear I didn't lie? You'll see for yourself. You'll apologize to me, and then I hope you feel ashamed and you tell me, 'Leonid, I'm so ashamed.'"
He wrinkled up his nose.
"Where are we going?"
"We'll follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick.
The musician sang, conducting with his forefinger. Then he dropped the case with his flute in it, swore, leaned down to pick it up, and almost tumbled over.
"Hey, you drunks! Will you even get to Kiev?" one of the guards called to them. "Thanks for your concern," said the musician, bowing to him. "We'll get there on the yellow brick road, and Dorothy will find her way home."
Homer had never believed in the legend of Polyanka, and now it had decided to teach him a lesson. Some called it the station of fate, and venerated it as an oracle. Some believed that a pilgrimage here at a critical turning point in life could part the curtains concealing the future a crack and provide a hint or a key, predicting and predetermining the path that remained ahead. Some, but all sober-minded people, knew that discharges of poisonous gases occurred at the station, and they inflamed the imagination, inducing hallucinations. To hell with the skeptics. What could his vision mean? The old man felt as if he was just one step away from the answer, but then his thoughts got tangled up and floundered, and he saw Hunter again, slicing the air with his black blade. Homer would have given a lot to know what vision had appeared to the brigadier, who he was fighting with, what duel it was that had ended in his defeat, if not his death.
"What are you thinking about?"
The old man was so surprised he felt a taut spasm twist his bowels. Hunter had never spoken to him without a compelling reason before, barked orders, the resentful growling of stingy replies. How could you expect a soulful heart-to-heart with someone who had no heart or soul?
"Oh, nothing really," Homer stammered.
"You're thinking. I can hear it,"
Hunter said in a flat voice.
"About me. Are you afraid?"
"Not right now,"
the old man lied.
"Don't be afraid. I won't touch you. You remind me."
"Of whom?"
Homer asked warily after half a minute's silence.
"Of something about me. I'd forgotten there was something like that in me, but you remind me,"
said Hunter, looking ahead into the darkness as he dragged the heavy words out of himself one by one and set them out.
"So that's what you brought me along for?"
asked Homer, simultaneously disappointed and intrigued. He'd been expecting something.
"It's important for me to keep it in my mind. Very important,"
the brigadier responded.
"And it's important for everyone else that I... Otherwise, there could be... what's already happened."
"Have you got problems with your memory?"
The old man felt as if he was creeping through a minefield.
"Did something happen to you?"
"I remember everything perfectly well,"
the brigadier replied sharply.
"It's only myself that I forget, and I'm afraid of forgetting myself completely. You'll remind me. All right?"
"All right,"
said Homer, and nodded, although Hunter couldn't see him just at the moment.
"It all used to make sense,"
the brigadier said with a struggle.
"Everything I did, defending the metro, defending people. People. The task was very clear. Neutralize any threat. Annihilate it. That was the point, it was.
But it is now, too.
Now? I don't know what it is now. I want everything to be as clear as before again. I don't do it just for the sake of it. I'm not a bandit. I'm not a murderer. It's for people's good. I tried living without people to keep them safe. But I got scared. I was forgetting myself really fast. I had to get back to people. To protect them, to help them. To remember. And then at Sebastopol, they accepted me there. That's my lair. I have to save the station. I have to help them. No matter what price I might have to pay. I think if I can do it, when I neutralize the threat, that's something really big, something genuine. Maybe then I'll remember. I must. That's why I have to move fast. Or else, it's moving faster and faster now. I have to get it done in 24 hours. Get everything done, reach police, collect the squad together and get back. But in the meantime, you remind me, all right?
Homer nodded stiffly. He was afraid even to imagine what would happen when the Brigadier forgot himself completely. Who would remain in his body when the former hunter fell asleep forever? Would it be whatever he was defeated by in today's phantom combat? Polyanka was far behind them now. Hunter was racing on towards Polis like a wolfhound that has scented quarry and been let off its chain, or like a wolf trying to shake off his pursuers. Light appeared at the end of the tunnel. They managed to drag themselves to Culture Park, and Leonid tried to make peace with the guards again, inviting them all to an excellent restaurant, but the guards were wary now. He almost wasn't even allowed to go off to the privy. After an exchange of whispers, one of the escorts agreed to guard them, and the other disappeared. "Got any money left?" the man on guard at the door asked bluntly. "A little bit," said Leonid, setting 5 cartridges on his outstretched palm.
"Give it here. Kostya's decided to shop you. He thinks you're a Red Agent. If he's right, there's a passage through to your line here. Well, you should know. If he's wrong, you can wait here for a bit until counterintelligence comes for you and barter with them."
"Unmasked me, have you?" said Leonid, trying to suppress his hiccups.
"Okay, so be it. We'll be back again. Thanks for the assistance."
He flung his arm up in an unfamiliar greeting.
"Listen, to hell with that passage. Just take us to the tunnel, will you?"
The musician grabbed Sasha and set off in front at an amazing pace, even though he was stumbling.
"How kind of him," he muttered under his breath. "There's a passage through to your line here. How would you like to go up on the surface, 40 meters down, as if he didn't know everything there was blocked off ages ago?"
"Where are we going?" Sasha didn't understand anything at all now.
"What do you mean, where? To the Red Line. You heard? They've caught an agent provocateur, exposed him," Leonid muttered.
"Are you a Red?"
"My dear girl, don't ask me any questions right now. I can either think or run, and running's what we need more. Our friend will raise the alarm any moment now, and he'll shoot us for resisting arrest. Money's not enough for us. We want a medal, too."
They dived into the tunnel, leaving the guard outside. They ran forward towards Kiev station, hugging the wall.
"We won't have much time to get to the station anyway," thought Sasha. If the musician was right, and the second guard was already pointing out which way the fugitives had gone. Then suddenly Leonid turned left into a well-lit side tunnel, as confidently as if he was walking home. A few minutes later, flags, metal gratings, and sandbags heaped up into machine gun nests appeared ahead in the distance, and they heard dogs barking. A frontier post? Had they already been warned about the fugitives? How was he planning to get out of here, and whose territory started on the other side of the barricades?
"I'm from Albert Mikhailovich," said the musician, thrusting a strange-looking document under the sentry's nose. "I need to get across to the other side." "The usual rate," said the sentry, glancing inside the hard binding. "Where are the papers for the young lady?"
"Let's make it double," said Leonid, turning out his pockets and shaking out the last cartridges. "And you didn't see the young lady, okay?"
"Let's just do without 'let's make it,'" said the border guard, putting on a stern air. "Do you think you're at the market? This is a law-abiding state."
"Oh, don't be like that,"
the musician exclaimed in mock fright. I just thought since it's a market economy, we could bargain. I didn't know there was a difference.
5 minutes later, Sasha and Leonid, mauled and disheveled, with a graze on his cheekbone and a bleeding nose, were tossed into a tiny little room with tiled walls. The iron door clanged shut. Darkness fell.
Chapter 16. In the Cage.
In pitch darkness, a person's other senses become more acute. Smells become more vivid, sounds become louder and more three-dimensional. The only sound in the punishment cell was from someone or other scratching at the floor, and there was an unbearable stench of stale urine. After drinking so much, the musician didn't even seem able to feel his own pain. He carried on muttering something to himself under his breath for a while. Then he stopped responding and started snuffling. He wasn't alarmed that their pursuers were bound to catch up with them now. He wasn't bothered about what would happen to Sasha without any papers or justification for trying to cross the Hansa border, and of course he was absolutely indifferent to the fate of Tula.
I hate you, Sasha said quietly.
He couldn't care less about that either. Soon a little hole appeared in the absolute gloom enveloping the cell. It was the glass spy hole in the door. Everything else remained invisible, but even this tiny gap was enough for Sasha. Carefully groping her way through the blackness, she crept over to the door and unleashed her light little fists on it. The door responded by rumbling, but the moment Sasha stopped hammering it, silence returned. The guards refused to hear the din or Sasha's shouts. Time flowed on, as slow as syrup. How long would they hold them prisoner? Maybe Leonid had deliberately brought her here. Maybe he wanted to separate her from the old man and from Hunter. Tear her out of the team and lure her into a trap. And all of this only in order to... Sasha started crying, burying her face in her sleeve. It absorbed the moisture and the sounds.
Have you ever seen the stars?
Asked a voice that still wasn't sober. She didn't answer.
I've only ever seen them in photographs, too,
the musician told her.
The sun can barely break through the dust and the clouds, and they're not strong enough for that. But your crying woke me up just now, and I thought I'd suddenly seen a real star. It's the spy hole,
she answered after swallowing her tears.
I know, but here's the interesting thing.
Leonid coughed.
Who was it that used to watch us from the sky with a thousand eyes? And why did he turn his back on us? There never was anyone there,
said Sasha, shaking her head abruptly.
But I've always wanted to believe that someone was keeping an eye on us,
the musician said thoughtfully.
No one's bothered about us, not even in this cell,
she exclaimed, and the tears welled up in her eyes again.
Did you arrange this specially, so we'd be too late?
She started hammering on the door again.
If you don't think there's anyone there, why bother knocking?
Asked Leonid.
You couldn't give a damn if all those sick people die. So that's the impression I give, is it?
That's a shame,
he sighed.
But as far as I can see, you're not so desperate to get to those sick people either. You're afraid that if your lover goes off to kill them, he'll get infected himself, and there isn't any cure.
That's not true!
Sasha had to stop herself from hitting him.
It is. It's true,
said Leonid, mimicking her squeaky voice.
What's so special about him?
Sasha didn't want to explain anything to him. She didn't want to talk to him at all, but she couldn't hold back.
He needs me. He really needs me. Without me, he's doomed. But you don't need me. You just haven't got anyone to play with.
Okay, let's suppose he does need you. Not exactly desperately, but he wouldn't say so. But what do you need him for, this ravenous wolf? Do you find villains attractive, or do you want to save his lost soul?
Sasha lapsed into silence. She was stung by how easily the musician could read her feelings. Perhaps there was nothing special about them, or was it because she didn't know how to hide them? That subtle, intangible something that she couldn't even frame in words sounded quite banal, even crass on his lips.
I hate you,
she forced out at last.
That's okay. I'm not so fond of me either,
Leonid chuckled. Sasha sat down on the floor and her tears started flowing again, first from anger, then from helplessness. She wasn't going to give up just as long as something still depended on her. But now, isolated in this cell with a companion who was deaf to her hopes and fears, she had no chance of being heard any longer. Shouting was pointless. Banging on the door was pointless. There was no one she could try to convince. Everything was pointless. And then suddenly a picture appeared in front of her eyes for a moment. Tall buildings, a green sky, clouds scudding along, people laughing. And the hot, wet drops on her cheek seemed like drops of that summer rain the old man had told her about. A second later, the apparition disappeared, leaving only a light, magical mood behind.
I want a miracle,
Sasha told herself stubbornly, biting on her lower lip. And immediately, a tumbler switch clicked loudly in the corridor, and the cell was flooded with unbearably bright light. A blissful aura of peace and prosperity extended out for dozens of meters from the entrance to the marble shrine that was the sacred capital of the metro, together with the white radiance of the mercury lamps. They weren't sparing with light in Polis because they believed in its magic. An abundance of light reminded people of their former lives, of those distant times when man was not yet a night animal, not yet a predator. And even barbarians from the periphery behaved with restraint here. The checkpoint on the border of Polis was more like the front entrance of an old Soviet ministry than an armored guard post. A table, a chair, two officers in clean staff uniforms wearing their peaked caps. A check of documents, an inspection of personal effects. The old man fished his passport out of his pocket. Visas had supposedly been abolished, so there shouldn't be any problems. He handed the little green folder to an officer and squinted sideways at the brigadier. Absorbed in his own thoughts, Hunter didn't seem to have heard the border guard's question. And did he have a passport in any case, Homer wondered doubtfully. But if he didn't, what had he been hoping for, hurrying here so fast?
I'm asking you for the last time,
said the officer, placing one hand on his gleaming holster.
Present your documents or leave Polish territory immediately.
Homer wasn't sure if the brigadier still hadn't understood what they wanted from him, and simply reacted to the movement of the fingers creeping towards the press stud of the holster. Instantly emerging from his strange, dormant state, Hunter flung his open hand forward with lightning speed, staving in the sentry's Adam's apple. The man wheezed, turned blue, and collapsed flat on his back, together with his chair. The other man tried to bolt, but the old man knew he wouldn't make it. The implacable, burnished pistol appeared in Hunter's hand like an ace out of a card-sharp sleeve, and—
Wait!
The brigadier hesitated for a second, and that was enough for the fleeing soldier to scramble out onto the platform, go tumbling over, and hide from the bullets.
Leave them. We have to get to Tula. You must— You asked me to remind you. Wait!
The old man gasped for breath, not knowing what to say.
To Tula,
Hunter replied dully.
Yes, best to be patient until we get to Tula, you're right.
He sank down heavily onto a chair, put his heavy revolver down beside him and lowered his head. Seizing the moment, Homer raised his hands in the air and ran forward towards the guards who were darting out of the doorways.
Don't shoot! He surrenders, don't shoot! In the name of all that's holy!
But even so, they twisted his arms behind his back and hurriedly tore off his respirator before allowing him to explain. The brigadier, who had fallen back into his strange lethargy, didn't interfere. He allowed them to disarm him and walked submissively through into the holding cell. He sat down on a bunk, looked up, found the old man, and gasped out,
"You need to find a certain man here. He's called Miller. Bring him here. I'll wait."
Homer nodded, fastidiously gathered up his things, and started squeezing his way through the sentries and curious bystanders crowding round the door, when suddenly he heard his name called.
Homer!
The old man froze in astonishment. Hunter had never called him by name before. He walked back to the lengths of reinforcing rods welded into unconvincing prison bars, and looked inquiringly at Hunter, who was hugging himself with his massive hands as if he were shivering with cold. And the brigadier spoke to him in a dull, lifeless voice.
Not for long.
The door opened and a soldier looked in timidly, the same one who had lashed the musician across the face several hours earlier. A kick in the backside sent him flying into the cell, and he almost tumbled over onto the floor, then straightened up and looked round uncertainly. A lean-bodied soldier wearing glasses was standing in the doorway. The shoulder tabs on his tunic were covered with stars, his sparse, light brown hair was sleeked back.
"Gone on, you dumb beast," he hissed.
"It's..."
the border guard bleated.
"Don't be shy,"
the officer encouraged him.
"I apologize for what I did, and I can't do it. That's an extra 10 days. Hit me,"
the soldier said to Leonid, not knowing which way to look.
"Ah, Albert Mikhailovich,"
said the musician, screwing up his eyes and smiling.
"I was starting to get tired of waiting."
"Good evening," said the officer, also hitching up the corners of his lips. "See, I've come to restore justice. Are we going to take our revenge?"
"I have to take care of my hands," said the musician, getting up and kneading his waist. "I think you can punish him."
"With all due severity," said Albert Mikhailovich, nodding. "A month in the guardhouse, and naturally, I add my apologies to this blockhead."
"Well, don't get too spiteful with him," said Leonid,
rubbing his bruised jaw.
"Is this going to remain just between the two of us?"
The officer's metallic voice grated treacherously, giving him away.
"As you can see, I'm smuggling something out,"
the musician said with a brief nod in Sasha's direction. "Can you relax the rules a bit?"
"We'll arrange it,"
Albert Mikhailovich promised. They left the guilty border guard right there in the cell. After closing the bolt, the officer led them along a narrow corridor.
"I won't go any further with you,"
Sasha told the musician in a loud voice.
"What if I told you that we really are going to that Emerald City?"
Leonid asked her after a moment's pause, speaking in a voice so low she could barely hear it.
"If I told you, it's no accident that I know more about it than your granddad. That I've seen it for myself. And not just seen it. That I've been there. And not just there."
"You're lying."
"You know what?"
Leonid asked her angrily. "When you ask for a miracle, you have to be prepared to believe in it. Or you'll miss it when it comes."
"And you also have to know how to tell miracles from conjuring tricks,"
Sasha snarled back.
"You taught me that."
"I knew from the very beginning that they'd let us go," he replied. "It's just that I didn't want to hurry things."
"You just wanted to drag things out and waste time."
"But I wasn't lying to you. There is a cure for the disease." They reached the frontier post. The officer, who had occasionally looked round at them curiously, handed the musician his belongings and returned his cartridges and documents.
"Right then, Leonid Nikolaevich," he said, saluting. "Are we taking the contraband with us or leaving it with the customs?"
"Taking it."
"In that case, peace and blessings upon you both," said Albert Mikhailovich.
He accompanied them past a triple row of fortifications, past teams of machine gunners who leapt up off their seats, past metal grills and tank traps welded together out of rails.
"I suppose no problems will arise with importation?"
"We'll break through," Leonid told him with a smile. "I shouldn't say this to you, but honest bureaucrats don't exist, and the harsher the regime, the lower the price. You just have to know who to pay it to."
"I think the magic word will be enough for you,"
the officer chuckled.
"It doesn't work on everyone yet," said Leonid, touching his cheekbone again. "As they say, I'm not a magician yet, I'm still studying."
"It will be a pleasure to do business with you, when you complete your studies."
Albert Mikhailovich bowed his head, swung round, and strode away. The last soldier opened a small gate through the thick bars of a grill that blocked off the tunnel from top to bottom. The stretch of line that began beyond it was brightly lit, and its walls were scorched in some places, and chipped in others, as if from long firefights. At the far end of it they could see new bands of fortifications, and the broad swathes of banners stretched between the floor and the ceiling. The sight of them was enough to set Sasha's heart pounding.
"Whose frontier post is this?"
she asked, coming to a sharp halt.
"What do you mean, whose?"
the musician asked, looking at her in amazement.
"The Red Lines, of course." Ah, how long Homer had dreamed of being back here again. How long it was since he'd been in these wonderful places. At Borovitskaya Station, that residence of the intelligentsia with its sweet smell of creosote and cozy little apartments built right there in the arches, and its reading room for Brahmin monks in the middle of the hall, long wooden tables piled high with books, low-hanging lamps with fabric shades, and its astoundingly precise reproduction of the spirit of the debating hall kitchens of the crisis period and pre-war years.
At regal Arbat station, decked out in white and bronze, almost like the chambers of the Kremlin, with its austere manners and brisk military men who still puffed out their cheeks, as if they weren't involved at all in the apocalypse. At the old, indeed ancient, Lenin Library Station, which they'd never got round to renaming while it still made any kind of sense to rename it, which was already as old as the world when Kolya first arrived in the metro as a little kid. The library, with its connecting passage in the form of a romantic captain's bridge right in the middle of the platform, with its painstakingly and skillfully restored moulding work on the leaky ceiling. And at Alexander Gardens, with its perpetually dim lighting, long-limbed and angular, in a way that reminded Homer of some weak-sighted, gouty pensioner constantly reminiscing about his young days in the Komsomol. Homer had always wondered if the stations were like their creators. Could they be thought of as their designers' self-portraits? Had they absorbed particles of the people who built them? One thing he knew for certain, each station left its own imprint on the people who lived in it, sharing its character with them and infecting them with its own moods and ailments. But Homer, with his peculiar cast of mind, his eternal pondering, and his incurable nostalgia, belonged, of course, not to Stern Sebastopol, but to Polis, as bright as the past itself. Only life had dictated otherwise. And even now, when he had finally got here, he didn't have even a few spare minutes to stroll through these halls, to admire the plaster mouldings and bronze castings, to indulge his fantasies. He had to run. With a struggle, Hunter had managed to muzzle someone inside himself, to cage that terrible creature that he fed from time to time with human flesh. But once it bent apart the bars of that inner cage, a moment later there would be nothing left of the feeble bars on the outside. Homer had to hurry. Hunter had asked him to find Miller. Was that a real name or a nickname, or maybe a password? Spoken aloud, it had produced a startling effect on the centuries. Talk of a court-martial for the arrested brigadier had dried up, and the handcuffs that were about to be clicked onto Homer's wrists were put back in the desk drawer. The pot-bellied head of the watch had volunteered to show the old man the way in person. Homer and his guide walked up a flight of steps and along the connecting passage to Arbat. They stopped at a door guarded by two men in civilian clothes, with faces that stated very clearly that they were professional killers. Behind them he could see a vista of office rooms. The pot-bellied man asked Homer to wait for a moment and tramped off along the corridor. Less than 3 minutes later he came back out, looked the old man over in amazement, and invited him to go in. The cramped corridor led them to a surprisingly spacious room, with all its walls hung with maps and diagrams or overgrown with notes and coded messages, photographs and sketches. A bony, elderly man with shoulders as wide as if he was wearing a Caucasian felt cloak was enthroned at a broad oak desk. Only his left arm protruded from the tunic thrown across his shoulders, and when Homer looked closely he realized why. The man's right arm was almost completely missing. The owner of the office was immensely tall. His eyes were almost on the same level as the eyes of the old man standing facing him.
"Thank you,"
he said, dismissing the pot-bellied officer who closed the door from the other side with obvious regret.
"Who are you?"
"Nikolai Ivanovich Nikolaev,"
the old man said, disconcerted.
"Drop the clowning. If you come to me, saying that you're with my very closest comrade, whom I laid to rest a year ago, you must have a reason for it. Who are you?"
"No one,"
said Homer with perfect sincerity.
"But this isn't about me. It's true he's alive. You just have to come with me, and quickly."
"So now, I'm wondering if this is a trap, an idiotic hoax, or simply a mistake."
Miller lit a papirosa and blew smoke into the old man's face.
"If you know his name, and you've chosen to come to me with this, you must know his story. You must know that we searched for him every day for more than a year, that we lost several men in the process. You must know, damn you, how much he meant to us. Perhaps even that he was my right hand."
He gave a crooked smile.
"No, none of that. He doesn't tell me anything,"
said the old man, pulling his head down into his shoulders.
"Please, let's just go to Borovitskaya. There's not much time."
"No. I won't go running off anywhere. And I have a good reason for that."
Miller put his hand under the table, made a strange movement with it and moved back in some incredible fashion, without getting up.
It took Homer a few seconds to realize that he was sitting in a wheelchair.
So let's talk calmly. I want to understand the meaning of your appearance here.
Lord,
said the old man, despairing of ever getting through to this blockhead.
Please, just believe me, he's alive and he's sitting in the holding cell at Borovitskaya. At least, I hope he's still there.
I'd like to believe you,
Miller said, and paused to take a deep pull on his papirosa. The old man heard the cigarette paper crackling as it curled up and caught fire.
Only miracles don't happen. All right. I have my own theories about whose hoax this is, but they'll be tested by specially trained men.
He reached for the phone.
Why is he so afraid of black men?
Homer asked unexpectedly, surprising even himself. Miller cautiously put down the receiver without saying a word into it. He dragged the rest of the papirosa into his lungs, right down to the end, and spat out the short cardboard butt into an ashtray.
Damn you. I'll take a ride to Borovitskaya, he said.
I won't go in there. Let me go. I'd rather stay here.
Sasha wasn't joking or being capricious. It would be hard to think of anyone her father had hated more than the Reds. They had taken away his power, they had broken his back, but instead of simply finishing him off out of pity or sheer prudishness, they had condemned him to years of humiliation and torment. Her father hadn't been able to forgive the people who rebelled against him. He hadn't been able to forgive the men who inspired the traitors and egged them on, or those who supplied them with weapons and leaflets. The very color red sent him into paroxysms of furious rage. And although at the end of his life he used to say that he bore no grudges against anyone and didn't want revenge, Sasha had had the feeling that he was simply making excuses for his own powerlessness.
It's the only way to get there,
Leonid said in dismay.
We were going to Kiev. That's not where you've brought me.
Hansa has been fighting the Red Line for decades. I couldn't let just anyone know that we were going to the communists. I had to lie.
You can't do anything without lying.
The door is on the far side of Sport Station, as I said, and Sport is the last station on the Red Line before the ruined metro bridge. There's no way to get around that.
How will we get in there? I don't have a passport,
she said, keeping her eyes fixed warily on the musician.
Trust me, he said with a smile. One person can always reach a deal with another. Long live corruption.
Ignoring Sasha's objections, he grabbed her by the wrist and pulled her after him. Blazing brightly in the glare of the searchlights in the second line of the frontier post, the gigantic red banners hanging from the ceiling rippled in the tunnel draft, making the girl feel as if she was looking at two glittering red waterfalls. A sign? If what she had heard about the line was right, the Reds ought to riddle them with bullets on the approaches, but Leonid strode forward calmly, with his lips set in a confident smile. About 30 meters from the frontier post, the broad beam of a searchlight struck his chest. The musician simply set his flute case on the ground and raised his hands in the air. Sasha did the same. The border inspectors walked up to them, looking sleepy and surprised. It seemed as if they had never met anyone from the other side of the border. This time the musician managed to take the senior officer off to one side before he asked for Sasha's documents. Leonid whispered something delicately in his ear. There was a faint jingle of brass, and the head of the border unit came back spellbound and pacified. He escorted them past the guard posts in person, and even put them on a hand trolley that was waiting, ordering the soldiers to go to Frunza station. They started working the levers, puffing and panting, as they got the trolley started. Sasha frowned as she studied the clothes and the faces of these men her father had taught her to call enemies. Nothing unusual. Padded jackets, blotchy washed-out caps with stars pinned to them, prominent cheekbones, hollow cheeks. No, they didn't have glossy skin like the Hansa patrolmen, but they were certainly no less human. They had a gleam of absolutely boyish curiosity in their eyes, a feeling that was apparently completely unknown to those who lived on the circle. These two had almost certainly never heard about what happened at Autosavod station almost 10 years earlier. Were they Sasha's enemies? Was it even possible to hate people you didn't know, not just formally, but genuinely? Not daring to strike up a conversation with their passengers, the soldiers merely grunted regularly as they leaned down on the levers.
How did you manage it?
Sasha asked.
Hypnosis,
said Leonid, winking at her.
But what were those documents you showed them?
She asked, looking at the musician suspiciously.
How can they get you allowed in everywhere?
Different passports for different occasions, he replied evasively.
Who are you?
So that the soldiers wouldn't hear, Sasha was obliged to sit close beside Leonid.
An observer,
he said with just his lips. If Sasha hadn't clamped her mouth shut, the questions would have come pouring out. But the soldiers were too obviously trying to catch the sense of their conversation, even trying to make the levers creak as quietly as possible. She had to wait until Frunze station, withered, faded and pale, rouged with red flags, pockmarked mosaics on the walls, columns nibbled on by time, ceiling vaults like dark mill ponds with feeble light bulbs dangling from wires stretched between the columns at a height slightly above the heads of the short local inhabitants, in order not to let a single ray of precious light go to waste. It was incredibly clean here. Several cleaning ladies were scurrying around the platform at the same time. The station was crowded, but the strange thing was that whichever way Sasha looked, everyone started fidgeting and bustling about, although behind her back all the movement immediately ceased and subdued voices started murmuring. The moment she looked back, the murmuring stopped, and people went back to their business, and no one wanted to look into her eyes, as if there was something indecent about it.
Are strangers unusual here?
She asked, looking at Leonid.
I'm a stranger here myself,
the musician said with a shrug.
Where are you at home?
Where people aren't so deadly serious, he laughed.
Where they understand that a man can't be saved with just food. Where they don't want to forget yesterday, even though the memories are painful. Tell me about the Emerald City,
Sasha said in a quiet voice.
Why do you hide?
The rulers of the city don't trust the inhabitants of the metro. Leonid broke off to explain himself to the sentries on duty at the entrance to the tunnel, and then, as he and Sasha dived into the intense darkness, he set a little light on the wick of an oil lamp with a metal cigarette lighter, and continued.
They don't trust them, because the people in the metro are gradually losing their human nature, and because they still have among them the people who started that terrible war, although they're afraid to admit it, even to their friends. Because the people in the metro are beyond redemption. They can only be feared, avoided, and observed. If they find out about the Emerald City, they'll just gobble it down and puke it up, the same way they gobble everything they get their hands on. All the canvases of the great artists will be burnt. All the paper and everything that was on it will be burnt. The only society that has achieved justice and equality will be annihilated. Drained bloodless, the university building will collapse. The great ark will founder and sink. And there'll be nothing left. Vandals, why do you think we can't change?
Asked Sasha, feeling offended.
Not everyone thinks that, said Leonid, giving her a sideways glance. Some are trying to do something. They're not trying very hard,
Sasha sighed.
If even my old Homer hasn't heard about them.
But then some people have actually heard them. He remarked suggestively.
You mean the music?
Sasha guessed.
Are you one of those who hope to change us? But how?
By coercing you into the love of beauty, the musician joked. The wheelchair was pushed by an adjutant, and the old man walked alongside, barely managing to keep up and looking round every now and then at the burly security guard attached to him.
If you really don't know the whole story, said Miller, then I'm willing to tell you it. You can amuse your cellmates with it, if I see the wrong man at Borovitskaya. Hunter was one of the Order's finest warriors, a genuine hunter in more than just name. His intuition was positively feral, and he dedicated himself to the cause absolutely. He was the one who sniffed out those black ones a year and a half ago, at the Economic Achievement Station. Hasn't anybody heard about that at all?
At achievements?
The old man repeated after him absent-mindedly.
Well, yes, invulnerable mutants who could read people's minds and make themselves invisible. I thought they were called the Dark Ones.
That's not important, Miller snapped. He was the first to dig up the rumors and sound the alarm. But just then we didn't have the men or the time. I told him no. I was busy with other matters.
He gestured with his stump.
Hunter went up there on his own. The last time he was in contact with me, he said that those creatures suppressed people's will and spread terror throughout the district. And Hunter was a simply incredible fighter, a born soldier who was worth an entire platoon all on his own.
I know, muttered Homer.
And he was never afraid of anything. He sent us a boy with a note saying he was going up onto the surface to deal with the Black Ones. If he disappeared, it meant the threat was worse than he had thought. He disappeared. He was killed. We have our own reporting system. Everyone who's alive is obliged to let us know every week. Obliged to do so. He hasn't been in touch for more than a year.
And what about the Black Ones?
We flattened the entire area thoroughly with whirlwind rocket salvos. Since then, nothing has been heard of the Black Ones either.
Miller chuckled.
They don't write. They don't phone in. The exits at the achievements were closed off, and life there has returned to normal. That boy also had mental problems, but as far as I know, he's been restored to health. He lives a normal human life. He got married. But Hunter, he's on my conscience.
He trundled down the steel ramp from the steps, startling and scattering the book-loving monks at the bottom of it, then swung round, waited for the panting old man, and added,
"Don't tell your cellmates the last part."
A minute later, the entire procession finally reached the holding cell. Miller didn't open the door of the cell. Bracing himself on the adjutant, he gritted his teeth, stood up, and pressed his eye to the spy hole. A split second was enough. Absolutely exhausted, as if he had covered the entire distance from Arbat on foot with his infirmities, Miller fell back into his chair, ran his dead gaze over the old man, and pronounced sentence.
It's not him.
I don't think my music belongs to me,
Leonid said with sudden seriousness.
I don't understand where it comes into my head from. It seems to me that I'm just a channel, simply an instrument. In the same way, as I put my lips to my flute when I want to play, someone else puts his lips to me, and a melody is born.
Inspiration,
Sasha whispered.
You can call it that.
He spread his arms in a shrug.
Whatever way it is, it doesn't belong to me. I don't have any right to keep it inside me. It travels through people. I start playing and I see these rich people and beggars gather round, all covered in scabs or shiny and greasy, angry ones and wretched ones and great ones. Everyone. And my music does something to them that tunes them all to the same key. I'm like a tuning fork. I can bring them into harmony, if not for long. And they'll chime so pure and clear. They'll sing. How can I explain that?
You explain it very well,
Sasha said thoughtfully.
That's what I felt myself. I have to try to plant this in them, Leonid added. In some of them, it will die. In some, it will sprout. I don't save anyone. I don't have the authority for that.
But why don't the other people who live in the city want to help us? Why are even you afraid to admit that you're doing this?
He didn't answer, and he remained silent until the tunnel ran into Sport Station, which was just as faded and withered, affectedly triumphant and mournful at the same time. But it was also low and cramped so that it weighed down heavily, like tight bandages round the head. This place smelled of smoke and sweat, poverty and pride. Sasha and Leonid were immediately assigned a narc, who loitered exactly 10 steps away from them, wherever they went. The girl wanted to move on straight away, but the musician threw cold water on the idea.
We can't go right now. We'll have to wait a bit.
He settled himself comfortably on a stone bench and clicked the locks on his flute case.
Why?
The gates can only be opened at specified times, said Leonid, looking away.
When?
Sasha looked round and found a clock. If it was correct, less than half of the time allotted to her was left.
I'll tell you.
You're dragging things out again.
She frowned and pulled back from him.
First you promised to help, then you tried to delay me.
Yes,
he said, gathering his courage and catching her eye.
I want to delay you.
Why? What for?
I'm not playing games with you. Believe me, I could have found someone to play with, and not many would have refused. I think I've fallen in love. My, my, how clunky that sounds.
You think? You don't even think it, you're just saying it, that's all.
There is a way to tell love from a game, he said seriously.
When you deceive someone in order to get them, is that love?
Real love shatters your entire life. It doesn't give a damn for circumstances, including games with all the rest.
I take a simpler view,
said Sasha, glowering at him.
I've never had any life. Take me to the door.
Leonid stared gravely at the girl, leaned against a column and crossed his arms, fencing himself off from her. He filled his lungs with air several times, as if he was going to rebuke her, but let it back out again without saying anything. Then he wilted, his face darkened, and he made a confession. I can't go with you. They won't let me back in.
What does that mean?
Sasha asked mistrustfully. I can't go back into the Ark. I was banished.
Banished? What for?
For good reason. He turned away and started speaking very quietly. Even standing just one step away from him, Sasha couldn't make it all out.
I was insulted by someone. An attendant at a library. He humiliated me in front of witnesses. That night I got drunk and set fire to the library. The attendant and all his family were suffocated by the fumes. It's a pity we don't have capital punishment. I deserved it. I was just banished. For life. There's no way back.
Then what did you bring me here for?
Sasha clenched her fists.
Why did you burn up my time too?
You can try to attract their attention.
Leonid muttered.
The door's in a side tunnel, and there's a mark in white paint 20 meters from it. Directly underneath the mark, at ground level, there's a rubber cover, and the bottom of the bell is underneath that. You have to give 3 short rings, 3 long ones, and 3 short ones. That's the code for returning observers.
He really did stay at the station, after helping Sasha to make her way past all 3 guard posts. He strolled back. As they parted, he tried to make her take an old submachine gun that he'd got hold of from somewhere, but Sasha wouldn't have it. 3 short rings, 3 long rings, and 3 short rings. That was all that could be any use to her now. And a lantern. The tunnels after Sport Station were gloomy and empty. The station was regarded as the last one on the line, and every guard post that the musician showed her through looked more like a small fortress than the one before. But Sasha wasn't afraid. Not at all. The only thing she was thinking about was that in an hour, or an hour and a half, she would be on the threshold of the Emerald City. And if the city didn't exist, there was absolutely no point in being afraid. The side tunnel was exactly where Leonid had promised it would be, blocked by a badly damaged grill in which Sasha easily found a gap wide enough to get through. And several hundred steps further on, it really did end in the steel wall of an emetic door, ancient and impregnable. Sasha diligently measured out 40 of her own steps from it, and spotted a white mark on the wall, which was damp, as if it was sweating. She found the cover immediately. Bending back the rubber, she felt for the bell button, and checked the watch that the musician had given her. She was in time. She was in time. She waited for a few more agonizingly long minutes, and closed her eyes. 3 short rings. 3 long rings. 3 short rings.
Chapter 17. Who's speaking? Artyom lowered his sizzling hot gun barrel and tried to wipe away the sweat and tears with the back of his hand, but the hand couldn't reach his face. The gas mask got in the way. Maybe he should just take the damn thing off. What difference did it really make anyway? The sick people must be roaring loud enough to drown out the bursts of submachine gun fire. Otherwise, why would more and more of them keep pouring out of the carriage to face the hail of lead? Couldn't they hear the thunderous rumbling? Didn't they understand they were being shot at point-blank range? What were they hoping for? Or maybe they couldn't give a damn anymore either. The platform was piled high with swollen bodies for several meters around the exit that had been broken open. Some of the bodies were still twitching, and a groan came from somewhere under the burial mound. The purulent flow from the open abscess of the doorway finally stopped. The people left in the carriage huddled up tightly together in terror, hiding from the bullets. Artyom glanced round at the other gunners. Was he the only one with shaking hands and trembling knees? None of them said a word. At first, even the commander was silent.
The only sounds were the wheezing of the overcrowded train trying to suppress a bloody cough, and the curse spat out by the last man still dying under the heap of dead.
"Monsters! Bastards! I'm still alive! It's so heavy!"
The commander finally spotted the man, squatted down beside him and emptied the remains of his cartridge clip into the poor wretch, squeezing the trigger until his empty gun started clicking. He got up, looked at his pistol, and for some reason wiped it on his trousers.
"Keep calm,"
he shouted hoarsely.
"Any further attempts to leave the infirmary without permission will be punished in the same way."
"What shall we do with the bodies?"
the men asked him.
"Put them back in the train. Ivanenko, Aksionov, let's do it."
Order had been restored. Artyom could go back to his post and try to get some sleep. There were still a couple of hours left until Ravalli, if he could just get at least an hour of shut-eye so that he wouldn't collapse on duty tomorrow. It didn't work out like that. Ivanenko stepped back and started shaking his head, refusing to take hold of the putrescent, disintegrating bodies. Forgetting that he had no cartridges left, the commander hissed in fury and held out the hand with the pistol towards him. The firing pin clattered uselessly. Ivanenko squealed and ran for it. And then one of the soldiers who was coughing flung up his automatic and stabbed the commander in the back with a crooked, awkward thrust of his bayonet. But the commander didn't fall. He stayed on his feet and slowly looked round over his shoulder at the man who had struck him.
"What are you doing, you bastard?"
he asked in quiet amazement.
"You'll do for all of us the same way soon. There's not a healthy man left in the whole station. We shoot them today, and tomorrow you'll drive the rest of us into these carriages."
The man yelled at the commander, trying to tug his bayonet out of him, but not firing for some reason. No one interfered. Not even Artyom, who took a step towards the two of them, but then froze, waiting. At last the bayonet came out. The commander reached for his wound as if he was trying to scratch himself, then went down on his knees, braced his hands against the slippery floor, and started shaking his head about. Was he trying to come to his senses, or did he want to fall asleep? No one could bring himself to finish the commander off. Even the mutineer who had stabbed him with the bayonet recoiled in fright, then tore off his gas mask and shouted loud enough for the whole station to hear.
"Brothers! No more torturing them! Let them out! They're going to die anyway, and so are we! Are we human beings or not?"
"Don't you dare!"
the commander wheezed inaudibly, still on his knees. The gunners started murmuring, conferring with each other. The bars were torn off carriage doors, first in one place and then in another. Then someone shot the instigator in the face and he tumbled over backwards to join the other dead. But it was already too late. With a triumphant roar, the crowd of infected people gushed out of the train into the hall, running clumsily on their thick legs. They tore the automatics out of the daunted sentry's hands and wandered off in various directions. The guards faltered too. Some were still firing at the sick people, but others mingled with them and wandered out of the station into all the tunnels. Some went north, towards Serpukhov, and others went south, towards Nagatino. Artyom stood there, gazing stupidly at the commander, who refused to die. First he crept forward on all fours. Then he stood up, slipping repeatedly, and set off to go somewhere.
"And now, for your surprise, you didn't think I'd be prepared for this,"
he muttered. The commander's wondering gaze settled on Artyom. He froze for a moment and suddenly spoke in his ordinary voice that brooked no insubordination.
"Popov, take me to the radio room. I have to order the Northern Guard post to close the door."
Artyom lent the commander his shoulder, and they wandered slowly past the empty train, past the fighting men, past the jumbled heaps of lumber, to the radio room, where the phone was. The commander's wound was apparently not fatal, but he had lost a lot of blood, and his strength deserted him before they got there. He went limp, and slumped into oblivion. Artyom shoved the desk against the door, grabbed the microphone of the internal switchboard, and called the Northern Guard post. The phone clicked a few times and wheezed as if it was breathing laboriously, and then it was silent, with a terrible silence. If it was too late to close off that direction, Artyom had to warn Dobrynin at least. He dashed over to the phone, pressed one of the two buttons on the panel, and waited a few seconds. The phone was still working. At first, the only sound in the receiver was a whispered echo. Then he heard a rapid clicking, and finally the ringing tone. One, two, three, four, five, six. Oh, God, let them answer. If they're all still alive, if they haven't been infected yet, let them answer. Let them give them a chance. Let them answer before the sick people can reach the borders of the station. Artyom would have pawned his very soul now just for someone to answer at the other end of the line. And then the impossible happened. The sound broke off midway through the seventh beep. He heard grunting and squabbling in the distance, and a cracked, agitated voice gasped through the rustling,
"Dobrynin station here!"
The cage was shrouded in gloom, but even in that meager light Homer could see that the prisoner's silhouette was too puny and too lifeless to belong to the brigadier, as if it was a stuffed dummy sitting behind the bars, limp and drooping. It looked like the guard. Dead. But where was Hunter?
"Thanks. I didn't think you'd reach me in time,"
said a dull, hollow voice.
"I felt cramped in there."
Miller spun his chair faster than Homer could look round. The brigadier was standing in the passage, blocking their way out to the station. His hands were firmly clenched together, as if one didn't trust the other and was afraid to let go of it. He turned his mutilated side towards them.
"Is that you?"
asked Miller, and his cheek twitched.
"Yes, for now,"
said Hunter, giving a strange little cough. If Homer hadn't known him, he might even have taken the sound for a laugh.
"What's wrong with you? What happened to your face?"
Miller clearly wanted to ask Hunter about something completely different. He gestured with his hand, ordering the guards to go out. They left Homer there.
"You're not exactly in the best shape either."
The brigadier gave that cough again.
"A mere trifle,"
said Miller, screwing up his face.
"It's just a shame that I can't give you a hug. Damn you! Where have you? We searched for you for so long."
"I know. I needed to be alone,"
Hunter said jerkily.
"I didn't want to come back to people. I wanted to go away forever, but I got scared."
"But what happened with the Black Ones? Did they do that to you?"
asked Miller, nodding at the purple wheels.
"Nothing. I wasn't able to destroy them."
The brigadier touched his scar.
"I couldn't do it. They broke me."
"You were right,"
Miller said with sudden passion.
"Forgive me for taking no notice at first, for not believing. At that time well, you remember. But we found them. We burned out the whole place. We thought you were already dead, that they'd... I wiped them out for you. For you! To the very last one!"
"I know," Hunter said in a hoarse, distraught voice. "And they knew what would happen because of me. They knew everything. They could really see people, and every person's destiny. You have no idea who we dare to raise our hand against." He smiled at us for one last time. "He sent them, gave us one more chance, and I condemned them, and you carried out the sentence, because that's what we're like, because we're monsters."
"What?"
"When I came to them, they showed me myself. It was as if I looked at myself in a mirror and saw everything the way it really is. I understood everything about myself. I understood about people, why it all happened to us."
"What do you mean?"
Miller stared at his comrade anxiously and cast a quick glance at the door. Perhaps he regretted having sent the guards away.
"I told you. I saw myself through their eyes in a mirror. Not the outside, but the inside, behind the screen. They lured me out in front of the mirror in order to show me. A cannibal. A monster. But I didn't see a man. I was terrified at the sight of myself. Something woke up. I'd been lying to myself before, telling myself I was protecting people. Saving. It was lies. I was just a bloody ravenous beast who tore out throats. Worse than a beast. The mirror disappeared. But it... this thing... stayed. It woke up and refused to sleep anymore. They thought I would kill myself after that. What did I have to live for? But I didn't. I had to fight. At first on my own, so that no one could see. As far away from people as possible. I thought I could punish myself so that they wouldn't punish me. I thought I could drive it out with pain.
He touched his scars.
Then I realized that without people it would defeat me. I was forgetting myself. So I came back.
They brainwashed you,
Miller exclaimed in an agonized voice.
Never mind. It's over and done with now, said the Brigadier.
He took his hand away from the wheels on his face, and his voice became dead and empty again.
Almost all. That story was finished long ago, and what's done is done. We're alone here now. We have to pull through on our own. That's not what I came about. There's an epidemic at Tula. It could break out to Sebastopol and into the Circle. Airborne fever. The same old deadly plague.
It hasn't been reported to me,
said Miller, eyeing him suspiciously.
They haven't reported it to anyone. They're being cowardly, lying. They don't know what to do.
What do you want from me?
Asked Miller, sitting up higher in his wheelchair.
You know that. The danger is to be eliminated. Give me a token. Give me men. Flamethrowers. We have to shut down Tula and purge it. Serpukhov and Sebastopol, too, if necessary. I hope it hasn't got any further.
Why,